Welcome back to the Smoke Pit Storytime Podcast. I'm your host, Vet Arcist OG. Just want to do some quick housekeeping. I'm going to try to start doing an intro to each episode, just trying to be a little bit more professional and try to make a better show for you guys. If you can, make sure you're subscribed to whatever podcatcher you use. Please take a minute just to leave a five-star review, you know, whatever podcatcher you're using. And if you can, go ahead and leave a review too, so that when other people come across it, they can see your support. Also, to share the show on social media. All these things help to boost the show and the algorithms and get it pushed out to more people. More people listen, and the more I feel better about myself. Anyway, you can find me, your host, Vetarchist OG, on Twitter, Smoke Pit Storytime on Instagram. And if you want, you can send me an email at smokepitstorytime@gmail.com for show suggestions, positive, negative feedback, whatever. This episode, I've got MD for Peace on Twitter, and he wanted to come on, and I wanted to talk to him about Defend the Guard US. And he was a civil affairs Marine for 14 years, did multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. Civil affairs is a pretty interesting job. I think we had a pretty good conversation. Went kind of long, and so I'm trying to keep shows to about an hour possible. So I broke it up into two episodes. Part one today, and I'll finish editing up part two and get that out to you as well. Take care, guys. For those that don't know about what, you know, because you wanted to talk about the Protect the Guard Act, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's my main thing that I've been, I got hooked on it about a year ago. Just that, you know, I'm an anti-war veteran and I don't know if I picked it up on Twitter. No, I wasn't even on Twitter yet. Somewhere along the way, it was a Scott Horton show interview with Pat McGeehan.
Huh? Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And Pat McGeehan is a West Virginia state delegate who's been kind of trying to push a rock uphill getting this bill that he created passed. And the idea is, you know, Congress is not doing their job and deciding whether or not to end this war, or really they never even did their job in the first place and declared war. And they won't, and Congress is just too big a thing to change or move. So the idea that he came up with was to try at the state level to pass a bill that says you can't use the National Guard unless the state's guard, unless there's a war declared.
Right.
And the idea was to try to go do an end run around Congress and take the National Guard out of all of the wars, which even at least as of like the last around March, they made a ad and they said there's about 30,000 National Guard members deployed right now, mostly operational deployments in Europe and stuff like that and little micro deployments. But if you tally it all up, it really adds up. And you know, I sort of, when I heard it, it really clicked that, yeah, I mean, if you take, let's just say I was the National, I mean, I don't know how you got overseas, but like a lot of those C-17s that go back and forth are National Guard C-17s.
Right.
They rely heavily on the A-10s, and the A-10s, like three or four of the 12 squadrons are state guard squadrons. And so if any one state really stepped up, and especially if a few did, and said you can't use the guard, it would really, really, I think, grind things to a halt.
Well, isn't legally speaking, whether or not the guard deploys is up to the governor?
So it's kind of an open question. There was a Supreme Court, the Congress can nationalize the guard, or the president can. That was the, you know, there's a whole to-do over whether the president could recently. But they can nationalize them for certain things. And there was the only real Supreme Court case that made a decision was at one point during the 80s, Reagan was trying to use a National Guard from Michigan to basically do, they were going to build a road or something like that, but the road was effectively meant to be built through the mountains to support the counterinsurgency in Nicaragua or something along those lines. So the Michigan Guard, the governor of Michigan, who was against Reagan in this, said that he refused to allow his guard to be used for it. And it became a Supreme Court case. And the court decided that they could be sent overseas. The Michigan governor's stance was you can't send our guard overseas for any reason unless there's a war. And the court said that they can be sent, but only for training. They never weighed in on whether they're allowed to be used for undeclared wars.
Mm-hmm. So they sent them for training.
Yeah, exactly. But there's still an open question, you know, are we at war, and would the AOMF have real legal standing to force the states to give up their guard to the wars? And so at the very least, it would end up being a Supreme Court battle if even one state passed this. Because, you know, if you hear Pat McGeehan talk about it, like, you know, the Pentagon's not that far from West Virginia, and they were hounding the Speaker of the House of West Virginia over this the first time that it almost kind of passed. It kind of slid under the radar, but as soon as it got to getting near a vote, all of a sudden the Pentagon freaked out. And I still think it has a shot. I mean, there were five states that were going to consider it this year, but then Corona hit. Mm-hmm. I was really pushing real hard in Maryland. I thought kind of if I took – initially, the only reason I got on Twitter was to try to get my state delegates' attention, because I noticed that one or two of them were pretty active on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And what I really want to do is try to get more – like I said, the Bring Our Troops Home is – they're sort of a right-wing affiliated. They're not really a libertarian organization, but they had a lot of names that you'd be familiar with, like Danny Scherzin showed up. They're trying to be open to coalition building, but they're trying to get veterans to push this bill over the hump in every state they can.
Right.
And so I tried here in Maryland, and I started trying to get the attention of our delegates on Twitter, and then I started emailing them and showing up at one or two of their campaign events, and basically they iced me out. They were just like not interested. Like they said, I got the attention of the speaker or the president of the Senate, the most senior Democrat. He wrote back to me and he said, "Well, if any discussion about this should arise, I'd be interested."
Mm-hmm. But he doesn't have the intestinal fortitude to initiate the conversation.
Exactly. So I'm still, I'm involved in the Libertarian Party politics here. So I'm trying to, the Maryland General Assembly doesn't meet again until next January. So the biggest thing now is Maryland Libertarian politics. But,
so you're herding cats.
Yeah. 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 I mean, right now, Maryland's, kind of got, they don't even have a duopoly, really. It's basically, you know, the Democrats control everything here, and they're trying to block. They took us off the ballot, and we've got to try to petition through Corona to try to get a couple thousand. You know, you have to get double what they require just because they'll throw half of them out.
Right.
Yeah, that happens. Got to get something like 4,000 more signatures for petitions before August, or there won't be a Libertarian on the ballot here. But after that, I'm going to try to start around, you know, after the election cycle's over, I'm really going to try to push the Libertarian Party here to, you know, at least some of the organization, but also really the Democrats here. I can't understand why they wouldn't go along with this bill. You know, it's like stick a thumb in Trump's eye, get ahead of him on his Bring Our Troops Home rhetoric.
Right. You know,
it seems like an easy win, but they, to date, haven't really given me the time of day. So
yeah, you'd think, you know,
but I think if they
actually got it done, they're like, look, he just talked about it, we actually did it, and then take the credit from him.
Right, exactly. That's, you know, I tried to sell that to them. I tried to be like, you know, he keeps trying and failing, and if you're the ones that actually kind of push the issue yourselves, you could be. That was one of my lines to this president, this guy Bill Ferguson. He's the, you know, president of Maryland State Senate. It was like, you know, why don't you, you know, act presidential, you know, like assert yourself onto the national stage in a, you know, in a pretty powerful way that's popular. I mean, something like 80% of Republicans, I was just looking at a poll from March, like support Trump's bring our troops home. And the Democrats have to at least be friendly to reducing troop numbers. You know what I mean?
You would think, I mean, for the longest time, Democrats were anti-war.
Yeah, I mean, at least in appearances.
Right.
You know, they still managed to start a lot of them, but.
True. That's true. But now, you know, the left seems to out neocon the neocons sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, this Russia stuff, I personally, starting back as far as 2015, I noticed a lot of weird stuff. As I was still, in 2014 was my last year on active duty. And we were in the, my job was teaching civil affairs, which I imagine you might be familiar with, haven't been in cell, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And so I taught at the civil affairs schoolhouse. And, you know, what's funny is even all of our scenarios and stuff, and we started getting more Estonian foreign officer, because we would get foreign officers there for training. Some, they weren't necessarily coming for civil affairs school, but they were usually sent here to go through infantry officers course or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then, well, they had downtime, like if they had a few months waiting between one course and another, they would just be like, here, we'll make yourself useful. Go to the civil affairs course.
Yeah.
But these guys would, we started getting more and more Eastern Europeans, and I started noticing more interesting stuff about everything started shifting towards Eastern Europe. And there was, you know, moving troops into Poland and all this stuff leading up to 2016. There was a massive exercise. And the Air National Guard now, just in March here in Maryland, did this, like, chemical weapon, like, you know, chemical weapon, sea burn environment. Can the A-10 stop the Russian tanks from getting through the Suwalki Gap, the little gap between Kaliningrad and Poland? Because that's like this critical gap that if the Russians were to close that, then all of the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, would be cut off from resupply.
Yeah, which is weird because when I went to the schoolhouse in 2000, it was still, we were, you know, it was Russia was always.
Yeah, it's always been Russia. They just can't let go.
No.
But I really sometimes think that they're pushing for it.
They are.
You know, that I don't know. I don't know the reasoning. I don't know why they'd want it. I don't know if it's just institutional knowledge, like you said, that the generals want the pitched theater piece battle in Eastern Europe that they've always dreamed of, you know, or if it's,
yeah. I mean, if you pull what a lot of people don't get is a lot of these flag officers, they don't want, you know, to bring the guard home. They don't want to end the wars because if they don't, they're going to get thinned out because they're not going to be needed.
Well, you know, I had already become sort of libertarian, more or less. I had made the switch by the time I got out of the Marine Corps. But in 2014, I remember thinking, I went to the sergeant's course, the staff academy, to get promoted, to maybe have the option of getting promoted. And all of these young Marines, these young sergeants were in this course. All of them have been less than 4 years, maybe a little bit more than that. All of them just had one ribbon, and all of them had spent their whole time in the Marine Corps painting rocks, looking pretty. Not one deployment among them.
Wow.
You know? And I just was sitting there thinking, man, the peacetime Marine Corps is miserable. It's not a fun place to be. Like, I had a decent job, and where I was, and the schoolhouse was pretty low-key, but the peace, and you got to think, there's probably a lot of generals out there that hate the idea of being a general in peacetime.
Yeah, because then they're just politicians.
Yeah, you know, where they're not gonna, they're never gonna make a name for themselves that way. You
can't get promoted.
Yeah, and so I wonder if just at the same level, at every level, there's people that just they don't want that, you know. Right. And rather than just turn swords into plowshares, they'd rather just make more war, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty gross.
Yeah.
You got to think, they're like, well, they're the threat. I'm like, well, why? You know, did we have anything to do with that? You know, that was the hardest thing for me to accept for the longest time, that our involvement around the world contributed to, you know, the domestic threat.
Oh yeah, that was one of the biggest jumps for me, like, to becoming an anarchist was this. It was, you know, as always, it's how are you going to defend yourselves, and what is the neutrality, like, there's threats in the world kind of stuff. I mean, it's what we ended up kind of interacting on Twitter over, was arguing with some guy about, you know, like, you know, how could we need this national, we need a robust national defense. It's like, but we also, do we really need to spend $1 trillion a year plus interest on whatever we have to borrow? And if you look at the numbers, I mean, yeah, there's like 1.25 million people in active duty, but then you have another 3 or 4 million that are contractors somehow, all like, and these aren't, you know, I don't vilify people that are in the military. I also don't hold them up on a pedestal, but on average, they're at least in better condition and of about average intelligence. And the people that are working as contractors or, you know, PhD people at universities getting grants, some of the best minds and healthiest bodies, a couple million of them, like a good, 10% of the labor force is dedicated all towards this one counterproductive end.
Well, it's counterproductive the way we see it, but it's productive for them, because there's a lot of, it's a big business.
Yeah. I mean,
multi-billion dollar a year industry. You know, like Smedley Butler said it best, war's a racket.
Yeah, it really is. And it's just, and you can't, it's hard to get people to see the unseen that, you know, this, all of that money could be better spent in any number of ways that people freely chose.
Right. You know, even if I don't agree with universal health care or all that stuff, all those socialist type programs. But if we weren't spending money on all this garbage overseas, then we probably could afford it, you know, or, you know, we could pay off our national debt pretty damn quick.
I mean, 20 years, it's been, we spent $1 trillion a year now, we're at 26 trillion in debt.
Yeah.
You know, that's, I mean, basically the length of the wars times the amount of money we, you know,
if that's, we just, it. Like, and it, and people naively had my hopes up when the Afghanistan papers came out.
Yeah, me too. That kind of, that's right when I got fired up.
Yeah. And no one read it.
Yeah.
No one cared. Even the generals, you know, even General Flynn back in 2003 is like, we have no idea what the hell we're doing here.
Yeah.
Why are we here? And that was in 2003.
Yeah, it's crazy. And what's really hard is you know, maybe I preach with the zeal of the converted or something like that here, but, like, you know, the more time I, like, at first, you know, the final thing that kind of convinced me to be, like, anti-war was to recognize all of, you know, I was always a conservative, generally speaking, or a libertarian, a conservatarian. I always felt like the government's too big, income tax, you know, all their standard taxation is theft was one of the early things that, like, I can get on board with that.
Yeah, like, but, Tea Party type.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's there's some good things there for sure.
Yeah. And that's kind of where I grew up, with the small government, you know, conservative mentality. And then when, I'm sure it was Tom Woods, I can't even quote it, but the general idea that he put through in some episode of his show was, you know, everything that I dislike about the state started during a war, the income tax from World War One, you know, inflationary policy, government being involved in Medicare, in healthcare in the first place, and then housing and in education were all offshoots of the GI Bill from World War II. You know,
and then all 67 with the federal college loan program.
Yep, and then you have drug prohibitions. The first alcohol prohibition was piloted during World War I, and then put into action right afterwards nationwide. But there was a brief period where there was prohibition just because of the war effort. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was like, and of course, then they get that taste of power and they try to make it permanent. And when I recognized that, that almost every crazy and the army, the standing army, really didn't develop until the Progressive Era. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until Wilson that we really had a peacetime major standing army, mm-hmm. you know, and
I'd probably even go back further than that. I would say probably Reconstruction.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah, that was an element to that.
Yeah, I kind of started to, I've been thinking this lately that, you know, the first Progressive Era was really under Lincoln.
That's true. And when you have that, and that really, and I think this might be, you know, going back to why it's maybe hard to get the left on board, because it's really what is, they have always viewed the military in a way that maybe you and I, even when I was in the military, you hear people all the time, whenever these social policy changes, like whether you know people could serve openly in the Marine Corps or in the military or women in the infantry kind of stuff, all those things, people will say the military is not a social experiment, it's a fighting machine, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, to most people it is a social experiment as much as, if not more than, a fighting machine.
Oh yeah,
it's all the a place where they can order and control and create their, to try to create a micro perfect society and test things out and experiment on you. Mm-hmm. You know, and
especially so from a totalitarian lens, because if you're in the military, you can't do a damn thing.
Yeah. And I think to there's an appeal to that to other people, that we should experiment here first, mm-hmm. you know, shift the, and so I don't know. I think that part of why it might be hard to get people to care is because they view, you know, the military, it's not just put on a pedestal. It's this special thing that they can use for whatever their ends are, and they don't want to just renounce it and give it up. But I struggle with trying to figure out how to get people to care. Like, for me, I made that switch to being libertarian because I saw all the ill domestic effects. I saw all the NSA spying on us. I saw all of those things. But later, it's sad. It's not right that I came around to this. I mean, there was a little bit when I was overseas. One of the things starting with my second deployment, I started noticing that, yeah, why do we're quartering in people's houses. We kick out the richest guy in the neighborhood because he's got the biggest house in the middle of the night and say, we're living here now. Sorry, bud. Maybe you can have it back in a week, maybe in a month, maybe tomorrow. I don't know. We'll give you some cash though, because I was a civil affairs guy. So I had to be there to like get the name of the guy and be like, well, you can come find us here and we'll pay you some rent after the fact, but you're out of your house now. This is our base. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking about, like, we're the redcoats, like, to myself at first, that we were the redcoats quartering people's houses, disarming them, searching them without warrants and all that stuff. And by my third deployment, I started talking to other Marines about it. Like, hey, like, I tried to use it as part of my civil affairs tools. It's like, try not to be a redcoat. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Try to, like, do you need to search this guy without a warrant? You know what I mean? Do you need to just randomly pat this guy down just because he's walking past our patrol or not? Like, because no one likes that.
There's put yourself in their shoes.
Yeah. And it would be easy. So I started trying to, I mean, to me, there was an element where I started thinking about Afghans and Iraqis as people just as much as you and me, which shouldn't be that much of a leap. But the military, I mean, in our society doesn't really think about them that way.
Oh, no.
The enemy, but then the military in particular. And, you know, more now, what kind of motivates me when I'm like, should I bother with this stuff or anything, is like thinking about the contractors that work for us that we abandoned, the orphans that we made, the people that we maimed by, like, shooting, you know, we skipped around off the ground and it hit this guy in the jaw and it blew his jaw off. And yeah, we paid him $2,500 for his pain and suffering, but, you know, that's not going to cover his whole lifetime of probably agony, right? You know, and we just leave that all behind. No one talks about it. And so I care about it all now, but I think sometimes that's what motivates me the most. But it's really depressing that no one else really cares. And I don't know if they have to see it for themselves, or, you know, getting people in Maryland or anywhere to care about foreign policy and, like, all of the ways it hurts people, just it's harder than it should be. you know?
Oh, I mean, if we don't do it over there, they're going to come over here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you hear this stuff and it's like, well, I'm not a, what do they call it? A Pollyanna that just believes that, oh yeah, everything will be perfect if we just left them alone. But it can't be any worse.
No.
You know what I mean? Can't.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine it being any worse when we're arming, you know, the last Al-Qaeda attack was a Saudi pilot that we brought here. I mean, we bring hundreds of Saudis here, if not thousands, every year, train them to fly and maintain jets that they use to bomb other people. And when you think about, like, you know, Bin Laden's chief complaint was that we were propping up an apostate, illegitimate monarch, and now we've armed them to the teeth. Mm-hmm. And then one of their own pilots turns around and starts shooting at us.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Just imagine if he had decided to use his F-18 that he was training on instead of a pistol against the other pilots in his ready room.
Right, especially during, you know, the live fire exercise.
Yeah. Just imagine if he had held out a little bit longer and, you know, got some hands on some live ordnance. You know?
Which wouldn't have been hard.
That would make 9/11 look like nothing. Because after doing a bomb run on something, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean...
And we're still bringing, and we still do it. Nobody's, that program hasn't been shut down. Still got hundreds of Saudis coming here every year to learn to fly fighter jets.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't think that's going to bite us.
Right. And especially, I mean, the whole world knows seems to know what's going on in Yemen, but no one wants to talk about it. And that's just one country
that we're
supporting.
I worked,
not supporting Yemen, but supporting Saudi.
Yeah.
You know, how many people have, hundreds of thousands of people have died in Yemen. And
it's crazy.
And
it's, you know, the latest numbers are absurd.
Yeah. And what did Yemen do to us? Nothing.
Nothing.
None of it's in the United States, you know, civilian population. Nothing that's going on over there is in our best interest at all. I mean, if it really was about Bin Laden and stuff like that, we could have wrapped that up in a month.
Yeah.
And been
done. I sometimes think that it has to do with, I taught history in Florida. I was a teacher for a little while there. And when I got out of the Marine Corps and went to grad school, and then I started teaching. And one of the things I taught kids was that if you look at a few key, like, I would show them this map of shipping moving through the globe. You know what I mean? Of ships moving around. And there's these few key points, like the Horn of Africa and the Dardanelles and Bosphorus between Turkey and the Black Sea. And these other key points where, like, global trade has to move through. And I sometimes wonder if it's just if it's really just about keeping thumbs on those scales and making sure that we have a presence to control those things, but we can't just make it about that. So they have to pretend. But what's interesting is I started meeting with the Maryland, when the little Iran flare up happened around December, I had been trying to reach out to this group, but they got active briefly. And then kind of think Corona put them back in their holes, but the Maryland, the local Veterans for Peace chapter. Mm-hmm. And these guys were funny because they were all mostly Vietnam vets who kind of had that sort of hippie activist thing about them, and a certain amount of respect. I gave them a certain amount of respect because these people, they were in their 80s, they were all like lawyers and retired, so it was a little bit easier for them.
Mm-hmm.
But these were the guys that were, I'm sure they like made it a habit of getting arrested protesting something, like breaking into the governor's office once a month and just locking themselves to a chair until they get a you know, a trespassing charge. And one of the things they were really fired up about that was interesting, and I was also just listening to your Blair Mountain episode, and it got me thinking about this. They were really fired up about trying to find out where the bombs that we ship to Yemen get put on the ships.
Mm-hmm.
They were really fired up about trying to figure out, okay, these bombs are making, because they heard a story, and I only learned about this from them. You don't hear libertarians talking about doing things like this, but I like the idea. And there was a story about a stevedores union in Italy. They didn't even refuse to load the bombs on a Saudi ship. It was a Saudi flagship that was they knew was carrying arms. I don't know how they found out. And they refused to, like, replace the generators on it. And it caused a whole bunch of pain for them. The stevedores union just locked the gates of the port and wouldn't let anyone in to do it. As a way to resist the war. And the Maryland Vets for Peace chapter here was really, really, that's what they were into, was trying to figure out where do these weapons get put on the boats and how can we get the union there to close it, shut it down, and not load those weapons and stop there. And I wonder if it'd be possible to get libertarians on board with that too. It's a, you know, kind of like with the, you know, they're, you know, unions aren't exactly what libertarians are all about. But when you talk about sometimes when they organize in the right way to achieve the right things, it might be, you know, worth trying to get that, you know, labor solidarity kind of stuff on our side.
True. Yeah. That's one thing I do have an issue with libertarians, because it's just they're, and it's not, I guess it's really not limited just to libertarians, so I don't want to just pick on them, but you get some people like, well, the Constitution doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. We see that, you know, the federal government and the state governments don't pay attention to their own constitutions. We get that. However, that is the framework and the matrix that we're operating in, so you need to know it. And if you really want to have a legal basis to fight, that's the route you got to go. Mm-hmm. And so the same thing would be with the unions. You know, come at the left from the left and the right from the right. Well, you know, unions, especially in shipping and things like that, that's the framework of that matrix that you probably should operate in. So why not get involved and try to make, it's a great idea. Because, the forklifts don't work. Guess we can't load the chips.
Yeah, I mean, how many people can operate the gantries? You know, there's only a handful.
Very few. Very few. And if they strike, nothing gets done.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't just go find a guy. They're going to have to go find another union guy to do that. Mm-hmm. And, we're going to go pull some guy from, you know, pull some guys from, you know, San Diego or whatever to go to do that. Well, what if, you know, unions don't like to fight other unions typically. They're like, well, they're on strike. No, we're not going to do that. They don't want to be a scab. Mm-hmm. So then,
I think ultimately the political means to change things. I'm a hopeless romantic when it comes to voting for more freedom. I keep trying and never getting anywhere, you know.
I know.
I don't have any like really, really false hope. I know that it's a long shot at best, but I have a penchant for the long shot for whatever reason. I just, you know, but I think really ultimately it's going to have to be some asymmetric means, like, and that this, you know, obviously agorism I think is probably the best way to kind of get away from the state, really. Yeah. It's hard to do.
Well, I think for a lot of things, for agorism, it's more. I don't know that at this point agorism is not going to starve the beast when the beast makes its own food.
Yeah,
What it does do, I think it if it makes sense for, on a personal level, to make your life better, and for you to not have to engage in the state as much, then it does make sense, and then you can then it, you know, that spreads to your next door neighbor. And then they get involved, and then you trade, and then it becomes, you know, your neighborhood, then your community, and then it kind of grows that way.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I regard it as if you could build stronger communities and start just getting more people, whether they are libertarian or not, to live without the state. You know what I mean? Just state in your life in this way or that way.
Right.
You know what I mean? Well, this is a kind of random tangent, but one of the things that always drove me crazy. I wasn't really involved in this either way, but, you know, you get in discussion. This is back, I was on Facebook or whatever. You get in discussions about gay marriage. It's like, why do you need the state to decide whether you could be married or not in the first place?
Yeah, the whole idea.
That question just never gets asked by some people. And the reason I bring that up is just to say more places that we can find just people and ask them, why do you need the state to be involved in X? And just get them thinking
right
about things that they take every day for granted, you right. know?
Well, the whole marriage license thing is a tax, and the whole reason it started was to keep interracial marriage from happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a good point to bring up in today's climate.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many things where it's the roots of it were actually meant to specifically harm a group, and then that just gets forgotten. You know, when it comes to minimum wage or drug laws, it's like the purpose of those things was explicitly at the time to harm a minority group, and now it somehow is holy writ that it can only be this way, and the racist roots of it are forgotten. Which is so strange. And when you bring it up, people don't even process it a lot of times. I just don't bring it up well enough, but trying to get people to kind of just think.
I've had that conversation about marriage. I'm like, you know, the state shouldn't be involved in it at all.
Yeah.
And then they'll bring up, yeah, but you know, for tax purposes, I'm like, well, let's talk about that.
Yeah. Step two. Why? Okay. So the government, you really want the government deciding like to creating and controlling incentives, pulling levers on deciding whether, well, you know, if you register your relationship with us, which is another crazy part. If you register your relationship with us, then we give you this special bonus of, you know, stealing a little bit less from you.
Right. You know? Or if you're a single mom and you have a bunch of kids, you know, and you don't have a relationship with the father, we'll give you more money. It's a whole perverse incentive structure.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it'd be really good to try to get people on board with, you know, starting to question in whatever way, you know. Another one too, I work with, immigrants a lot, and a lot of, my latest thing with like Libertarian Party politics is I really want to get, I'm hoping at some point to organize an event. I don't know how. I'm just beginning with this. It's a nascent idea, but to get somebody, maybe like Jacob Hornberger, somebody who's fluently bilingual, and my Spanish is not, and really reach out to people who are willing to cross borders, break laws, drive without a license, and live. For a better life, you know what I mean? To take that entrepreneurial spirit and move 5,000 miles from Guatemala to Baltimore City and carve out a better life without, you know, maybe they get a fake social security or a taxpayer ID number to try to avoid some of the political problems, you know, to try to avoid the police. But, you know, people that are willing to go to just move freely and live freely in a way that, you know, that even though despite the state stacked against them.
Yeah, there's probably enough people that are already here. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's millions and millions of people that have come here, and whether they have what, you know, people like to talk about, immigrants vote Democrat because it's in their interest. I mean, I can see the argument. I don't know that it's true. I haven't seen a big enough sample size. I think, you know, there's a little bit of enculturation.
Yeah, I could see that, especially, you know, certain places in South America tend to be more show, you know.
Yeah, I don't know that it's so deeply ingrained. And if you could find somebody who speaks the right language of, like, you ought to be free to move.
Yeah.
You ought to be free to work. Yeah. You know what I mean? And we're the only ones selling that. You know, the hardest things in your life, the things that make you suffer the most, are worrying about somebody taking you and sending, like, after saving up thousands of dollars, moving thousands of miles, and eking out a slightly better existence here, and hoping to reunite your family, because most of the time it's, you know, father moves first, and then assuming they manage to maintain their long distance relationship, which often breaks up the family. You know, father has kids in Guatemala. He moves first, starts working and saving more money to bring kids, and then hopefully mom comes after that, and the family's finally reunited, if it works out. But it causes all, and you know, if somebody could just put that bug in their ear that there's people out there here in America who think that you should not have to look over your shoulder every time the police are around, or when you're driving your truck to or from work, worry about whether or not you have a license. You know, there's a group of people out there that say that it's not that we need to want to reform it. It's that we want you to be free. Like, we want you never have to worry about that again.
Yeah. A lot of that, you know, a lot of people's fears about that, you know, and I'm sorting through that too myself. But it seems like a lot of what I hear, you know, well, you know, then people get on welfare and things like that. And whether or not that's true or not, I don't know. But then I'm like, well, why is there a welfare state? What is, if that's true, then why is there the incentive? You know, why have that incentive in the first place?
Certain things like, so when it comes to one of the, you know, everyone will say, well, they get enrolled in school and school costs money. But, you know, wherever they're renting from, the landlord there is paying a property tax, and property taxes are paying for the schools. So, like, they're paying in just as much as any other renter in the neighborhood is, as far as that goes.
If you live in an apartment, you're not paying property taxes out of your, you know, you, part of your rent
is, you know, going there. That,
right.
Yeah. And so I think some of the error really, like, it's true. They probably take a lot of people, you know, people as much as somebody else in the same financial situation, you know, but that's a problem with the welfare state. It's not a problem with having someone hardworking and entrepreneurial and risk-taking come here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're not the problem in that equation. Oh, well, we have this welfare state, so these people are coming here and they're going to tax our welfare state harder. Well, you know, the problem there is obvious. It's the welfare state is, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And I had a real good friend of mine when I lived in South Carolina, and he was from Mexico City, and he was not a fan. He was pro immigration, but he definitely had his issues with the system. And, you know, what he had, he was a lawyer, but he didn't speak English or anything like that. And of course, he would have to go to law school again if he moved here after he learned English and things like that. He grew up, his grandfather and father were carpenters. So he went through the system, and it ended up costing like $25,000 and took, you know, all this time. He moved here, washed dishes while he was taking English classes, learned how to speak English. You know, the thing that, and just did everything. He's like, you know, I did everything I was supposed to do. I learned how to speak English. I, you know, started my own business. I married a white woman. I did all, you know, you know, that was the joke. But, yeah. You know, he definitely said that there's things that do need to be changed. You know, he's pretty hardcore conservative. And actually, he's one of the people that kind of introduced me into libertarianism. Mm-hmm. But he's like, you know, it's a bureaucracy like any other. And he's just, you know, in the Marine Corps, you saw it. There's just people that just put things in place just to justify their existence, because if it went away, then they have to go do something.
Oh yeah.
You know,
this always astounds me in so many different situations. In general, people that never really think, they think legality and morality are the same. I don't know. No. Oh, so many people, when it's so obviously not true, but like a sort of offshoot of that or a related thing is how many people just, when you put a checklist in front of them, all of a sudden all of their mental faculties evaporate. Mm. You know what I mean? If you give somebody a checklist that says, well, you know, do you speak English? Do you do this? Have you done this? Have you done this? And it doesn't matter if the person could have been in, like, let's just say, you know, sort of using your friend as the example, you know, they could check off all but one box and then 1,000 more boxes that don't exist. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It could have been, the person could immigrate and be as American as apple pie. And still, if they don't have that last box on the list checked, the person who's going to give them their official certification from the state that you're a legitimate person now can't even begin. They just see the blank box and they can't think past it. And there's, right, it's like bureaucratic checklists just remove all, like, I don't know how people's brains evaporate when you put a checklist in front of them. They stop thinking and it's just, you know.
Mm-hmm. And how many times did you hear in the Marine Corps? Well, it's not in the manual.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody told me to do that. It's like, well, yeah, I shouldn't have to tell you to put gas in the truck, like that, you know, or whatever the case may be. It's like, there's certain things that you should just know, like, just if you turned your brain on for a minute. But what the state does is turn people's brains off to a certain extent. They just say, well, we got it for you. All you got to do is check the boxes and we've got you.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, what about this? Don't worry about that.
Yeah. And people are happy to do it, I think, to a certain extent. They don't, there's a, you know, life's not easy just navigating relationships and children and everything else. You know, it's sometimes I feel like, I mean, I've got a nice one bedroom apartment, a decent job, a great fiance, and I feel like I still can't keep up just with family and, you know, this just job, family, and the basics of life. So, you know, it feels like just I'm chasing my tail constantly just to keep the status quo, mm-hmm. You know? And my life isn't even that hard. You know, I'm not even saying it's that hard. It's just for people find comfort, I think, in like not challenging that status quo whatsoever. They don't want to, life's hard enough already.
Right.
Like, I don't want more like, I'm happy to have the state take certain decisions away from me about how things will happen, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of that, it's weird, you know, take debt, for example. Mm-hmm. Most of us are in debt. I'm in debt. I'm getting out of it. My wife just paid off all, you know, no credit cards, no car payments, no student loans, no nothing. Yeah. And she's like, talked about the freedom that she feels.
Yeah.
And now she's not having to chase that. You know, so she's like, I can focus on other things now.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as a society, you know, like the credit score, mm-hmm. If you pay off your credit card, your credit score goes down. And then I swear every time I make a credit card payment or I'll throw like a big chunk, like a couple hundred dollars at it and just pay off a chunk. I'll get two credit card offers in the mail. Oh damn, he's almost out of debt. We got to get him back in debt to keep him back on the, you know, whatever. So that, you know, you're just so focused on making your payments that you can't focus on anything else. Or it's like, I can't make waves because I'm living paycheck to paycheck and something happens, I'm screwed. And, you know, we saw that.
You're out above water.
Exactly. Economically. Yeah. I mean, we saw that during like this whole Corona bullcrap, how many people are screwed.
Yeah. And then the government comes in and gives you this little pittance or, you know, just here in Maryland, I can't recall exactly, but they're talking, you know, there's still this back and forth over, you know, rent relief, rent relief and people that can't and eviction relief, you know, how long can they stay the evictions? The governor here is talking about extending it for a few more months, but like, and what that's done too, and for this shocking number of businesses that are, you know, commercial real estate, which is supposed to be a pretty steady, safe place to put your money, you know, there's so many businesses that aren't paying their rent right now, mm-hmm. you know, or are paying less than they could, you know. And I mean, really, I think, you know, this is just standard libertarian stuff, but in the inflation that's been happening, that people don't see that there's a reason that you're never, ever going to get your head, you're never going to get out of water. Your head's just always going to be just above water, and they're going to keep it that way. They're going to keep pulling the levers of the economy to make sure everyone is just a step away from drowning, because that's where they most are willing to take a hand up for help. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's the way I think the government really wants things. They want people to feel like they're just never there. And, you know, and it's always got to be the state that just bails you out left and right.
Right. When it's the state that caused the issue in the first place.
Well, yeah. And nobody sees that, like, yeah, that you're, the analogy is going to break down here, but it's like their foot's on your shoulder, or they strap weights to your ankles and then are offering you a hand up while you're drowning.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Like,
It's like that meme where the guy's drowning and his hand's reaching up, and then the hand just kind of high fives and pushes him back down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no. Yeah, so I mean, I do think that there's, I mean, obviously the corona thing, it's, I'm very curious what's going to come out of it and how long they're going to drag it on for and to what end, you know, but, and how much it's been a distraction from so many other things, you know, every state government, most of which are on the verge of bankruptcy and they can't print their way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every state government is right now figuring out how on earth they're going to keep up the financial fiction, like, you know, public schools trying to figure out how on earth they're going to pay, like going to pay to stay, like keep all their employees. The governor here is talking about losing, you know, there's some battle with the comptroller here about, you know, how many public works employees they're going to have to fire. And the governor's like, well, I don't want to fire any of them. And it's like, okay, you're theoretically a Republican, but like, you know, they're saying they recognize that they have to deal with scarcity in the world, that there is a scarcity of money for them, theoretically, mm-hmm. until the government. But what's going to happen is the government's going to bail them out. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, that's why I see this whole defund the police thing. you know, I saw a lot of libertarians cheering this on. I'm like, don't get too happy, because the people that are pushing this don't think the same way that you do.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of this, where you see it start to catch on, they're not wanting to get rid of the police. That's not the whole thing. They're out of money. And so what's going to happen is that I think that a lot of these, the police departments, they're not going to go away. They're going to be federalized.
You're right.
That's going to get way worse.
Yeah. I mean, that's the craziest part is I kind of jumped onto that hashtag, let's say, and I really tried to co-opt it. I knew it was maybe a bit of a fool's errand, but I was really trying to co-opt it and get people like, yeah, let's do FBI. Let's do DEA. Let's do all narcotics units. You know what I mean? Let's start there. Like, let's start with, some, you know, in general, I didn't get into it with anyone, but I sort of started going back and forth with some people that were in the, you know, the BLM defund the policing, and it wasn't a negative interaction, but I just tried to point out, like, I saw it was something where they listed all their demands, and I was like, well, a lot of those like are fine, like greater oversight of the police or cutting certain parts of the budget for the police and all that, but like, don't you see that every single one of the, there's not a single law being removed, there's exactly. not a single, none of your proposals are actually designed, like, what about just, we're not even going to talk about ending the drug prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
I think a lot of that, none of it's designed to do that.
Huh?
I don't think any of it's designed for that.
Yeah, it's not, but it's amazing to hear people kind of, they'll hum along to the hymnal of the defund the police thing. But when you ask them like, well, like what, like, can we just decriminalize life in the city? You know, can we decriminalize just normal everyday behaviors that people engage in, whether it's, you know, buying a plant or whatever, mm-hmm. you know?
But just like that, the perverse incentives, if the thing actually gets fixed, then they don't need to be there.
Yeah.
And they lose their power and their funding, you know. That's why you see so many things get co-opted.
That's what's really funny. Every now and then when I see something about like the Electoral College pop up, or the latest is like the DC statehood is a big, at least in some of the things I, you know, on your mainstream, like Wall Street Journal or New York Times podcast are talking about DC statehood and mm-hmm. how it should or shouldn't exist and all that.
Puerto Rico as well.
Yeah. And how, you know, people will talk about how they, you know, it's an obvious, both sides know it's a political move. It's to get more senators. But when you just throw out there, like, I'll just kind of throw a little thought out there, like, you know, when it comes to the Electoral College, or they'll say that they're, you know, they want more electoral power is what they want. They want more power in the Electoral College. It's like, you know, when it does, it only takes a simple majority bill to add 1,000 new representatives.
Mm-hmm.
We could go from 435. That's not written in stone. It's not in the Constitution. It's just a statute. Mm-hmm. And they could go from 435 to 10,000 tomorrow if they had the political majority to do it. Mm-hmm. And if they made it 10,000, Wyoming would still have one. And California and New York would have 700 representatives votes for the president each. Mm-hmm. You know, Wyoming and Delaware and all those micro states would be diluted. So all this grousing about, oh, the electoral college, blah, blah, blah. When you kind of take an alternate tack and be like, you know, there's a simple solution that they could have enacted in 2008 when they had the House, Senate, and the presidency.
Right.
But they didn't, because they don't want solutions.
No.
They never want a solution. They want people not to recognize, if anything, they absolutely don't even want people to know that there could be a real solution. Mm-hmm. Because what they want is a problem that they can go back to over and over again. They can just keep drawing from the infinite well of the Electoral College, of you name it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was like, you see stuff like Bernie Sanders. He was like, when I become president, I will legalize marijuana. I'm like, dude, you've been there 40 years. You haven't said one damn word about it in the whole 40 years.
Yeah.
But you've been there. Why not? You know, you're not serious about that. And like Joe Biden, you know, all this stuff. I'm like, you're the father of all of the laws that, you know, that target minorities.
What's really funny, and I really think they're, I think partially it's the population being ignorant of this, but also there's a real, I've noticed this, and I noticed it when I swear, I think, or maybe I just picked this up from my father and I just have been harping on it lately, years ago. But you'll notice that anyone that wants to be a legislator almost exclusively is asked about and talks about what they would do if they were the executive. Anyone that wants to be Maryland State Legislature would talk about what they would do if they were governor. Right. You know what I mean? And anyone that wants to be president talks about what they would do if they were a legislator. You know? Bernie Sanders saying, if I were president, I would enact Medicare for all. Well, okay.
The president can't do that.
The president can't do that. And then you have, you know, somebody running for the Senate talking about what they would do if they were president. And I swear, I mean, I really think the media is complicit in it, but also sure. I think politicians are very well practiced at doing it, where it's almost second nature. And people are, whatever, it's just, it seems like people are really obviously trained into just never seeing it. They'll always talk about, well, you know, when
haven't taught civics in school in decades.
When Justin Amash was like briefly thinking about running for president, you had all these people coming out and saying, well, you know, he voted for this or that law and he's evil. And it's like, well, you know, he couldn't vote for that law if he was president. You know, I just throw that in there. Like if he was, you might actually want him, if you are against him voting for this or that bill, whatever it was, I can't even recall, it doesn't matter. But it was some person from the left complaining, well, he might be good on anti-war, because I always try to open the door with the anti-war stuff with the left. Sure. He might be good on anti-war, but he voted against Medicare for all or something like that, and therefore he can't be president. It's like, well, you know, actually he'd do less harm as president then. And they just, their brains, they can't figure that out, you know? He would be terrible as president, you know? It's like, you know, if you don't want to make laws, then maybe this is better for you. But
right. It looks like the same people that are saying, you know, Joe Jorgensen, she's saying she's going to, you know, eliminate the ATF. And someone goes, well, she can't do that. I'm like, well, it falls under the executive. So, yeah, the executive created it. So, yeah, they probably could.
The very least, I'm pretty well convinced that there's a weird thing, that there's a thing called impoundment, because Nixon tried to do this. He basically tried to, like, withhold money to some agency he didn't like. Mm-hmm. And the court found that he couldn't do that. But I'm curious, and I know that this would be a colossal waste of money in a certain sense, but I'm reasonably certain the president could furlough all of them, paid or unpaid. Probably you might have to actually just do paid. But if Jorgensen like came in on day one, she could say, all of you go home and lock the doors to the ATF and be like, you're still going to get your paychecks. Just shut up and go home and don't do any work. Mm-hmm. You know? And eventually the absurdity would be obvious to all this, you know, and that they should just be fired. Yeah. But I think I'm curious. I'm not sure if she could do that. What was interesting too, and I was just talking to some local libertarians about this, is for a while, I was a Tulsi supporter for the same reasons. There were a lot of people, libertarians I would talk to and stuff like that. And she wasn't perfect on the war issue, but she was by far the best and had a more, had at least as good of a shot as Jorgensen does now, let's just say.
Right.
Of becoming president. You know what I mean? If not
she better. Was open to talk. She was open to have a discussion at least.
And I was for her because she could deschedule marijuana. She could, as president, she could bring 100%. The truth down as president. Those would be powers she could enact. And you'd hear libertarians and stuff talk about, well, and also, like I said, I was trying to win over the left of Maryland to the anti-war, like to generally be friendly to them. Because that's who I need to support me to get Maryland to defend the guard. But then I would be talking to libertarians here and there, and they'd be like, but how could you hope that she wins the Democrat because she's for Medicare for all? And it's like, well, as president, she couldn't make that happen.
Exactly. She could be whatever she wants.
She as president could do.
Right.
And the things that she could do and says she would do as president are things I can agree with. So I could be comfortable with that.
Right. And I think that's such a tactic. Oh, go ahead. I was going to say, I think that's such a tactic as politicians, because to me, they're all actors anyway.
Yeah.
But you brought up a really good point. If they're running for this, they talk about what they would do.
Yeah.
That's not within their powers. So you see all these people as president. Well, I'm for this and this and this. I'm like, yeah, but you can't do any of that. So it sounds great. And people are like, yeah, let's vote for them for that. They can't do any of that shit.
Yeah, and then it's a never ending cycle, because then they get upset that it didn't happen, it's funny because they don't blame them. They're like, oh, well, the House held them. The damn Republicans in the House stopped Obama right. from doing X or whatever. I don't even know what's there.
But when he had the House and the Senate, he didn't do it then either. So,
but yeah, it's they do it and they do it so well. And and the really sad part is everyone. And like I said, the reason I brought up the Tulsi thing was to show that like even libertarians can be guilty of it. Like, well, she supports X too. And it's like, but as president, she can't do it. And so like even people that are pretty switched on and know things generally about these things are so well trained into this, like, well, if everything of not sorting out the things that they're claiming they will do against what actual powers they would have in that position.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, it's just learning. Like, that's why I brought up, you know, learning actually what the Constitution, like, what is it?
Yeah. And yeah, it's very sad that people just can't understand this really basic concept. Or like I said, to a certain extent, everyone's kind of guilty of it a little bit, but it's just, you look at the whole agenda of person X and you kind of just evaluate that. And a lot of times you just look for like the one thing you hate about them. And then people hone in on that and they never do that sorting of, well, you know, what are the realistic prospects here and all that. And
I see it for like state Senate races. You'll see it. Like, it's all a cult of personality. It's because there's no policy anymore. Like, I'll see it. There's someone here. I can't remember their name. They're like, they're like, if you elect me a senator, I will support Donald Trump and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, that's not your damn job.
Yeah.
That I don't care who the president is. I don't, you know, that your job is not to support whatever they want. Mm-hmm. Your job is to defend and uphold the Constitution of the United States. That's it. That's all you're there for. And so I'm like, I wouldn't vote for you just because you said that. That's just stupid.
Yeah. Well, what's funny too, so here in going back around to the defend the guard thing, one of the other thing, what's funny about it too, is politicians are kind of happy to use the shield sometimes of they're very happy to use the I can't do that shield. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not my power. Because one of my state delegates, his name was Luke Clippinger, the first thing he said is, well, I'm in the judicial department, so I can't file that bill. You know what I mean? It's like, well, all right, well, but what do you think about it? And do you know anyone that could file the bill? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm the chair of the Justice Committee, so when this wouldn't really fall under Justice Committee business. So, sorry, not sorry. You know,
right?
And I forget which state delegate responded to me and basically said, "Well, that's a foreign policy issue. It's not a state of Maryland issue. So you need to talk to your congressman." It's like, no. I agonized over the letters I wrote to them, and I was very clear that this is a state level end run around Congress. Mm-hmm. And that this is your opportunity to really like assert yourselves into something that the Congress has completely abrogated its responsibility for, you know?
Yeah.
And immediately when you ask them to do their job in a certain context, they're like, nope, can't do that. Not my job, you know?
Right.
Very quick to, but that, you know, that they would never bat an eye about talking about things that aren't their job when they're trying to sell themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when they're being asked to do something that's not on their agenda, they're like, no. And they put the excuse wall up.
Right.
You know? And I guess people do that a lot of times. I mean, people generally, when they're asked to do something that's outside of their, you know, if you ask me in my job to do something that's not part of what I like doing about my job, I might hide behind this excuse. You know, people will do that. People will naturally do that. Not my job, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe that's part of it. But when it comes to sad, weird part about politics that even I'm maybe guilty of feeling is like that these people should be my servant. You know what I mean? I think that's the way it should be, maybe, but I know that it's not, you know? But even I'm like, well, look, you're my delegate, and I want you to represent this. And since you don't seem to have an opinion on anyways, and neither does anyone else, then you should listen to my opinion.